The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening, brought to you, as always, by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP, financial services provider, to the uninitiated. Arthur Goldstuck is standing by. In a moment, though, once we chat to Arthur Goldstuck about why the internet broke today, we'll get some chabalala as to why his share price broke today. That's a little unfair. Good results out of Standard Bank. Market, however, concerned about the outlook for the South African economy and, of course, for banking shares in general. We've seen APSA come off quite sharply. First Rand is holding in. Capitec is holding up quite well. But yes, we'll pick up with some chabalala in just a moment. We'll also pick up with the CEO of Exxaro Resources this evening and understand what it is about wind power that is fueling some of the returns, at least for Nombasa Tsengwa, who's the chief executive at Exxaro. Gideon Novick, who was part of the Takatso Consortium many moons ago and then left when his lift business took off. We'll talk to him about the failed SAA Takatso deal. There's lots to come tonight here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
It's so true. As humans, we really don't tend to appreciate things until they're gone. And today's internet outage wreaking havoc for many, including us. We've been doing everything using wind power and prayer to get the show on air today. Something terrible happened to our internet connections. It affected emails. It affected lots of different things. Arthur Goldstuck is the founder and chief executive at Worldwide Works in Johannesburg. And he knows more things about the internet than the internet knows about him. Arthur Goldstuck, tell me why the internet broke.
Good evening, Bruce. The main reason is that three major cables feeding the west coast of Africa and southern Africa went down at the same time. And we don't know why they went down, but when multiple cables go down simultaneously, it usually means that there's been some kind of incident at sea, like an underwater earthquake or an underwater rockfall. Believe it or not, you get rockfalls under the sea. And the last time we had a major outage like this with multiple cables affected, that's exactly what happened. And it took down what was then the West Africa cable system and Telkom's SAT-3 cable. The SAT-3 cable doesn't really make a big difference to the world these days. But in this case, the West Africa cable system went down along with the main one cable and the ACE cable. ACE is the Africa to Europe cable. So clearly something happened under the sea, and it must have been some kind of underwater earthquake. So there was another cable feeding this part of the world called the Equiano cable, which Google actually laid down along the west coast, and that wasn't affected. That clearly has followed a different route.
But, I mean, this is weird, isn't it? Because here you've got the cable, and then you've got a backup of the cable, and you've got a backup of the backup, and all three of these got taken out today. Because, do they put them in a single tube? Do all of the cables follow the same route? It's kind of strange. I suppose it does make sense in some respects, but also makes it vulnerable.
Yes, what happens when they lay down a cable is they have a survey of the seafloor and want to see what is the best route for the cable to follow to avoid those kind of rocky areas, very deep parts of the ocean, etc. So typically what happens is they all find the same easy route. And it's just by good fortune that Google's Equiano cable didn't follow that same route. But it gets worse, Bruce, because what's also happened in the last week or so is that on the east coast of Africa, going up through the Red Sea, the undersea cable connecting the Seacom cable, which was our first big independent cable that broke the Telkom monopoly about 2 decades ago, that suddenly was out, not in its own right, but in terms of its connection to Europe going through the Red Sea. And people were blaming the Houthi rebels for their bombing activity on ships going through the Red Sea. So that still hasn't been repaired, and chances are that these cables are going to take a while to repair. The previous time we had this kind of incident, it took a few weeks for the repair ship to get out there and fix the cable.
So what are we operating on then? Is there like this Gosmuth and Google cable that's keeping everybody going this evening? Or is there more to it than just one lifeline to the rest of the world?
Luckily, there's now a dozen or so cables. The issue is the services that you use, which cables do they have contracts with? Where are they connecting through? So you're going to have Sim on shortly talking about Standard Bank. You could ask him, because if you looked at Standard Bank and FNB's connectivity, it went down when the cables went down, but it came back up again. So they obviously have backup services. They have redundancy, they call it, where they can connect up to multiple cables. But not many businesses do that. If you are a cybersecurity company like Trend Micro, for example, you might make sure that you are on all of those undersea cables. So it doesn't matter how many go down, chances are you'll still be connected. With a bank, you'll probably have two or three redundancies. Netflix, they're still down. That's really a crisis. They probably only have one redundancy. So one has to actually look at having multiple forms of backup to make sure that you can keep going when the rest are going down.
Are we going to notice the effects of today's outage for a while yet to come, or are the redundancies sufficient to sort of pick up where things left off at about noon today when everybody suddenly noticed a slowdown?
It all depends on how effectively organizations have negotiated their backup. So it looks like the Microsoft services are all back, slower, but they clearly have arranged those redundancies better than most. The banks also, because any lost minute online is lost revenue. The mobile operators as well, although it took some of them a little longer than it should have to come back online. But the smaller outfits are going to be affected for much longer. And I'm afraid if you play Call of Duty, for example, you're going to be in trouble for the next few days.
Excellent. Trying
to get it properly connected.
Good news on that front. Homework will be completed. Thank you, Arthur Goldstuck, very much indeed. Arthur Goldstuck explaining beautifully, as he always does, South Africa's vulnerabilities in terms of technology. The founder and chief executive at Worldwide Works, Arthur Goldstuck, tonight on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
To Sim Chabalala we go now. Sim is the chief executive at Standard Bank. And before we talk results, Sim, were your banking services affected today at all by the big internet outage?
Bruce, very limited. Good afternoon, first of all. Lovely to chat to you as always. Very little impact on clients. But our productivity tools that we use, which are Microsoft-based, were affected from roughly 12:30 this afternoon to roughly 4. And as Arthur says, because of redundancy, we were able to get back online. I have, however, tried to use Copilot, which is Microsoft's AI tool, and it says to me it can't help me right now. But the point is that tools are now back.
Good news, because I was wondering where you were going to get the answers to the questions tonight. And if AI is not working, Sim, I don't know what we're going to do. Your results today, really strong. I mean, profits up 27%, the share price coming off quite sharply, though. The results tell us where you have been. The share price response tells us where the market thinks you are going. Market knocked you down 6% today. Is it wrong?
Bruce, the market is never really wrong if you believe in the efficient markets hypothesis, but it takes time for them to digest the information. So first of all, at 200 Rand a share, following the guidance given during the course of the year and culminating in the profit, in the trading update that we gave a couple of weeks ago, it would have been reasonable then to assume that everything is priced in. When we released our results today, I think the market hadn't had enough time to digest our guidance, which we gave, basically saying we expect net interest income to be in the low to middle single digits, and non-interest revenue low single digits. I think people saw that and they thought, my word, there are headwinds coming. But what they didn't see is the fact that we are operating in countries whose currencies are depreciating against the rand, So that affects our fees and commissions and our net interest income, but it also affects our costs because there's going to be a concomitant decline in the rate of increase in our costs. And I think once the market digests all of that, you will have a correction. So the market is efficient, Bruce, but they will work through the data and make the right conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough environment in which to operate, of course. Your bad debts are rising, your impairments are up by a third, and even if we do get rate cuts this year, and you're anticipating as a group that there will be three this year and one further one next year, it does feel like even when these rate cuts do eventually materialize, that there's still quite a lot of pain for households that are teetering on the edge of whether or not they can cope financially.
Yes, Bruce, the credit impairment charges at Standard Bank were 16.2 billion rand this year. That was 22% up. That is enormous. Let me just give you another statistic which you'll find fascinating. Our stock of provisions on our balance sheet is 64 billion rand. And just think how many listed companies that entails. Of course, we consider that as interest rates decline and as inflation declines, as people's jobs improve, you saw the Labour Bulletin report that the third quarter and fourth quarter people's jobs were in better shape than they were compared to previous periods. And then, of course, you saw that wage settlements in many instances are now ahead of inflation. So people getting greater salary increases than inflation. That should work through the system. We expecting then our credit impairments to reach that peak in the first half of the year and then start to improve and decline off the back of that decline in interest rates, inflation, improved salaries, greater disposable income, and better debt to disposable income ratios. Hello, Bruce. I think we've got been cut off. This happened last.
I was reading between what you were saying earlier. Sorry, I muted myself there. Silly Sim.
I thought we had a similar experience to what we had last year.
Exactly. It's all finger trouble and it's all me, I'm afraid. So, Sim, here we've got a situation where in between now and those interest rate cuts, whenever they do come, we've got an election. And I wonder if you are wary of election outcomes, as so many South Africans are, who are looking at the polls, and the polls are giving disparate perspectives as to what might happen in the future. How do you plan through what could be a shape-shifting election cycle?
Bruce, it's not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. I guess the best we can do is look at the various scenarios. Our political analyst, our political economist, says that there are three. 25% chance that the ruling party gets more than 50%, 15% chance that it gets less than 45%, and a 60% chance that it gets between 45% and 50%. In the most likely scenarios, there is very little likelihood of massive change in policy trajectory. And therefore, when investors ask us, this is the answer we give them based on those scenarios. If there's an eventuality in terms of which the policy trajectory slows down because either there is complacency in the ruling party or because there is a coalition which does not work, you then have got tail risks in that scenario. But Bruce, we believe that South Africa is a healthy democracy. The elections will be free, fair. They'll be noisy. There'll be difficulties, but I think broadly we will be fine.
The FT this week, for the first time in a very, very long time, publishing a more upbeat view of South Africa. And I did notice much of what they were basing the piece on was as the result of the work that your economist Simon Fremantle has been doing, is quoted extensively. The narrative does seem to be shifting, however, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. And there are many. That's because Bruce, people are noticing the data. And again, investors would be saying to themselves, well, is South Africa going to deal with its electricity challenge? Yes. Well, there's 12,000 megawatts under construction. That's two massive power stations that there is evidence coming from Stats South Africa that there is greater freight rail moving and more stuff moving through our ports. It is now that the Pier 2 is now run by an international company. The state and business and organs of civil society are working closer together. There is more. There are now 30, more than 30 countries on SA's e-visa, which will increase the movement of people. The spectrum, the auctioning of the spectrum was amongst the best in the world. Therefore, the likes of MTN, Vodacom, and the other telcos are, you know, paying for their licenses, rolling out fiber, rolling out their towers. And so when you add these things up, it's no longer a case of green shoots. It's a veritable crop that people are seeing.
Yeah, it's yeah. Again, unfortunately, change when it's negative happens really, really quickly, and it's very scary. Progress happens slowly and doesn't draw nearly enough attention. And I think that is why the deep work is so important. And that deep work, again, so much of what comes through in your results now, your other African markets component of your earnings, makes up 42% of your headline earnings. It's actually astonishing to see that growing proportion of your earnings coming from other markets, and it does show the importance of the long term. Because your predecessors were beginning to, I think, invest in many other African economies, at least tentatively, probably as far back as the 1980s. And, you know, you've obviously built on that over time, and these businesses have grown, and you've refocused your energies on those markets since then. But again, progress does take an awfully long time.
Oh, Bruce, you hit the nail on the head. The current management stands on the shoulders of great men and women, Dr. Strauss, Eddie Perron, and so forth. And they built the strategy the way back when. If you recall, they made that acquisition in 1992. They bought the ANZ Grindy, which operated in South Central and East Africa. It's the backbone of this Africa region entity that you're talking about. Now, hear this, Bruce. They made 18.2 billion rand. South Africa made 16.8. They generated a return on equity of 28%. The cost of equity for the Standard Bank Group is just above 15%. So not only are these businesses growing fast, 49%, the return on equity is high, 28%. They're generating huge economic profits, shareholder value. And again, it's decisions made by great executives long ago. So you're 100% right.
And so all the more important that decisions are made today, of course, that much more important 10, 20, yeah, 30 years from now. It's a big job. Sim Chabalala, thank you. Chief Executive of Standard Bank joining us this evening on The Money Show. The contribution from the rest of the African markets becoming an increasingly important part of Standard Bank's results. Profits up 27% overall, most of that from outside of South Africa, most of the growth outside South Africa, and the market taking a bit of a dim view on the outlook. Sim Chabalala suggesting they've got it wrong.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Rudy Funimadova we go. Rudy is with Advice Works, and your old colleagues at your old stamping ground of Standard Bank doing rather well now, even though the market doesn't seem to share some self-confidence about the near term. Rudy, good evening.
Good evening, Bruce. Yeah, it's a good set of results. There's no doubt there. They seem to be firing on all cylinders, and their revenues are up very strongly. They seem to be managing their margins quite well. There's quite a sharp increase in costs. One understands is obviously that I think the demands on salaries at the moment are obviously higher with inflation running where it is, but costs have increased, OPEX costs quite substantially. But it is a good set of results. I think the market taking partly a dim view, and I think a lot of the reasons for that have been highlighted already. But you know, just the outlook is maybe not as exciting or clear as maybe the market had hoped. Is one part of that. But I also think there is an element of possible concern on the relatively speaking. I think the quality of the results is maybe not quite as good as that of First Trends. And by that, I mean that there's possibly a higher element of risk involved in them. So there's quite a big chunk of earnings that came from trading profits, so, which were at record levels. So trading profits actually were fantastic. They're up 20%. So no complaints about that, but it has become quite a big chunk of revenues, and trading profits can be fickle. You can be, you know, they're not consistent, as consistent as fee and commission income or interest revenue, for example, is. And then I think there is some uncertainty probably related to the extent of the African earnings now. It was, as you mentioned, 10 or 20 years ago, a very small piece of earnings, but now it's very material. It is 42%, and it probably within a year or two could be above 50%. And that's where the bulk of the growth came from. So 49% of the growth came from offshore and only 3% from South Africa. So South Africa was quite a dull set of results. But Africa has uncertainties, with it. We've seen currency devaluations and debt defaults. And we know that from time to time one can get surprised in some of these places. So from that perspective, I think there's a little bit more uncertainty attached to the outlook for earnings than maybe there would be for a company or for a bank that produces 98% of its revenue in South Africa.
And but again, the future is African, frankly. And so the positioning may very well pay off strongly. Talk to me about Exxaro, a bit like Kumba coming out of the post-COVID sort of heady highs, I suppose, and returning to more normality in terms of performance.
Yeah, very much so. So they were a big beneficiary, I suppose, to some extent of the Ukrainian situation. There was a massive shortage of coal, and coal prices were very, very high in sort of 2021-ish, 2022. And so there's been a pullback in coal prices, certainly. And the actual dollar price received was down by, for export coals, and down by in the region of sort of 53-odd%. So quite a sharp pullback there. I think they were bailed a little bit by domestic prices and by the rand. But revenues were down 17-odd%. Their profits were down 34%. Headline earnings down 22%. So they certainly are under pressure, but their balance sheet has been in a good position. They are still very cash generative and very profitable. And the company had already priced in a lot of risk. So the share price already is reflecting a lot of the uncertainty, and actually rose quite nicely today. But it's really, really cheap, for a company producing massive amounts of cash flow on a PE of in the region of sort of 3.5, and it pays a dividend yield of about 10%. So there's certainly
amazing, isn't it?
Some attractiveness to it at this level.
Rudy Funabadva, thank you very much indeed. Rudy is with AdviceWorks. Brings us to 6:30, this Eyewitness News Now, brought to you by Khalix. Khalix for the businessman who knows what he wants. Here's Maki Malapo.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I thought it was very rude of Tola Kele to look at me in the way she looked at me when I said to her, it's a Wednesday. I like Wednesdays. Wednesdays are one of my favorite days. Thursdays are better. Apologies, Tola Kele. I think I freaked her out just that little bit. I'm not on the next Money Show, by the way, because that's logistics. But we've got Africa, who is going to be at the start of the Cape Epic. I think it's going to be marvelous. It is a beautiful race, the APSA Cape Epic. It is a massively challenging and grueling endeavor. By hundreds of cyclists who participate, and the logistics of it and the scenery and just the sheer force of willpower that participants have got make it a spectacular, spectacular event. I'm very sorry not to be at the start this time round.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
For the first time in 30 years of COP meetings, the final statement in December in Dubai, and I was very lucky to be there, specifically signaled that countries should move away from fossil fuels, and they acknowledged that it is necessary to reach net zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. And there wasn't the ban that some activists had hoped for, and that's created breathing room for companies like Sasol and Shell and others. Today I see Shell weakening some of its climate targets to accommodate plans it has to keep growing its gas business. And of course, the world needs energy, and until we can come up with sustainable and sensible alternatives to the stuff that is doing the damage, we are going to be dependent on fossil fuels. And I know the activists don't like that sort of statement, but it's simply a fact of life. Shell today publishing a first 3-year review of its energy transition plan. It launched it in 2021, and the company's saying the net carbon intensity of its products would fall more slowly than previously planned. I mean, there's a lot of jargon in there, isn't it? But they are looking to become less damaging than they were, but not chucking the baby out with the bathwater. So Shell's shareholders and Sasol shareholders and others will be relieved. Certainly globally, we're seeing commodity producers retreat from the post-COVID super profits that they generated. Rudy von der Merwe explained it well, saying the energy shortages in Europe as Russia invaded Ukraine were very good for companies like Exxaro, for example, which is a big coal producer. But more and more, we're seeing it shift to other energy sources. The chief executive, Nombasa Tsengwa, is with us. And despite slowing down, Nombasa, I mean, the profits are slowing and that's very, very clear. You are paying a special dividend, which I think is an encouraging signal in an environment where a lot of people are worried about dividend flows into the future, that you've still got good cash flows, you're still generating good income, and that there is money to spread about a bit.
Hey, Bruce, good evening. And, good evening to your viewers. It's always great to be on your show. Indeed, you know, Exxaro is in a good position, you know, of very strong balance sheet. And that's driven by a few aspects, you know, over years, as we've talked to you before, very good cash containment and also cost containment. And going into this year, we have a very good year in terms of the price that we realized against the API 4 index. And this is driven by our high product mix in terms of quality. And we're able to play in high quality markets, and then we're making that margin. So yes, very strong. Yes, they had challenges in terms of the offtake of Eskom that really did impact our cash cost to some extent, but we were able, on top of what we had been preserving from a cash perspective, to make some good cash so that we're able to keep to our promise of returning the excess cash to shareholders. And that's where we then were able to pay that excess, that is the 5 rand 72 cents. Yeah, 72 the of world, the special DV.
The world would love to see you stop mining coal. The world would love to see you transition into green energies tomorrow. And that's impossible, of course. You are, however, growing the contribution of green energy. And I'm guessing it's a very, very tiny proportion of your earnings at this stage. But your energy business generated 727 gigawatt hours of electricity. That's, I think, what, 8, 9, 10% more than the previous year. Coal is a long-term asset, but, I mean, do you see a time 15, 20 years from now where Exxaro is no longer producing coal, where it is this green energy producer, whether it be from sun, from waves, from the wind?
Bruce, the reason we have this preservation of cash between 12 and 15 billion rand is exactly to help us do that, to diversify our business and de-risk it from the vagaries of the coal markets. So we've said before, we are looking at investing into the likes of copper, manganese, bauxite, and also looking at other minerals, you know, that will also be of value to the just energy transition. And one day, you know, we see ourselves maybe 2030 growing our green electron generation from a base of 229 megawatts today and upping that to 1.6 gigawatts come 2030. So yes, that's why we're keeping this cash to do exactly that.
Nombasa Tsengwa, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. Dr. Nombasa Tsengwa is chief executive at Exxaro. The transition of big companies in the fossil fuel space to cleaner energies taking its time, of course. Everyone's also noticing, and it was the stats that Sim Chabalala was talking about earlier in terms of the slow progress that doesn't get reported on all the time, and certainly you don't see slow progress getting reported about in context, and you don't get slow process being reported about as a block, because these things happen slowly and are less dramatic than the big negative events that afflict us, you know, far too often. But just, you know, things like this, the slow improvements of Transnet and others having a positive impact. Yesterday, a lot of people were freaked out by the collapse of the Takatso deal with SAA. At one stage, Gidon Novick, who was CEO of Comair, he was a co-founder, of course, of Lifty, created the low-cost airline industry in South Africa via Kalula.com, and his family has been involved in the airline trade since, I don't know, wings were invented almost. But Gidon Novick was part of Takatso, and I'm curious as to his views this evening as to the failure of that Takatso deal. Gidon Novick is coming up next.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Welcome to The Money Show. Gidon Novick joins us this evening, and I expressed the view last night that I wasn't surprised that the SAA Takatso deal had not gone through. I suggested ideology and greed were always going to get in the way of a deal whose terms were agreed 3 years ago, and there seems to have been a lot of shifting of positions in the interim. Since then, of course, Gidon Novick, who at one time was part of the Takatso consortium with a rich history in aviation, has formed Lyft and is growing, of course, in the South African environment. He opted out of Takatso probably about a year ago now. Were you relieved to get out of that consortium in the pitch for SAA, Gidon? Was the writing on the wall for you, what, when?
Yeah, it was about a year ago, you're right, Bruce. It was quite disappointing. I mean, it really was something quite aspirational and potentially inspirational, I guess, to get involved in a state asset that had been so troublesome for so long. It cost taxpayers, I don't know, 50 billion rand or so. And, you know, really had, we thought, the potential to become something quite special. You know, not only commercially viable, but something that really could have been an icon for the nation, carrying the South African flag. So it was quite appealing. But you know, a year ago, we kind of realized it was going to be a dead end. We weren't being fed any information. And fortunately, pulled out at that point. But it is disappointing that these types of things don't happen, and, you know, that, you know, these state assets that really have potential and could do great things are left to, you know, kind of linger and cost taxpayers endless amounts of money.
You've long been a critic, of course, of the state-owned airline sector, and particularly when SAA created Mango and you were running Kalula.com at the time and as CEO of Comair for part of that period. Very, very critical of the way in which the state chose to compete. And even though it was competing, from your perspective, from an unfair vantage point, it could never make money out of it. It was being run badly. It was being run corruptly, as we know from the Zondo Commission. South African taxpayers have continued to carry the liability. I found it interesting, the minister in the presidency today, Ms. Ncaveni, suggesting that a deal is not off the table completely. I wonder what the economics would be for a deal like this to happen with perhaps a new buyer, should anyone, of course, be interested.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, the most important thing, I think, which I was encouraged that the minister, when he made the announcement on the deal being terminated, said that there will be no more taxpayer funding going into SAA. So, you know, I know that's been said before and promises broken. So let's not hold our breath. Yes. But, you know, at least it's on record and it needs to be viable on its own. And, you know, private capital could help. Skills, you know, definitely are critical to make any business work, let alone a difficult airline business. So
there's no excuse to be running an airline, though, Gidon. I mean, there are enough skills. There are enough people who know what they're doing. There are enough test cases to show how you can run an airline profitably and effectively. And there's no excuse to be running one at a loss. SAA has no excuse for being loss-making. It's been cut to the bone. They're hardly flying any routes anymore. They've got rid of the unprofitable, politically inspired international long-haul routes and, sadly, some very profitable good routes as well and valuable landing spots at places like Heathrow. There's no excuse for it. I mean, there is an opportunity here, I would think, as objectively as you can, of course, as an airline professional, to say, actually, there is a business case for SAA run properly with proper partners. Could we find a new partner for SAA, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, this experience, one has to look critically at what went wrong and, you know, clearly lots of things. So it would need to be a different set of circumstances. You know, the market's also moved on, Bruce. You know, there's not just ourselves coming into the market and making some inroads, but, you know, on the international side, you've got the best airlines in the world operating into and out of South Africa. I mean, we're actually quite spoiled if you think about the range of choices that we have in terms of international carriers. So that's an extremely competitive space to get back into. And the regional routes as well. You know, Air Link has done a great job getting onto those regional routes and establishing themselves really well there. So, you know, things have changed since SAA was the big airline that it once was.
What would need to change from a South African perspective to make SAA attractive to bring back Emirates, which at one time was interested, or any other potential partner to support South Africa in running a successful flag carrier?
Yeah, well, it's tricky. You know, one of the things which has been topical is, you know, there's foreign ownership restrictions in South Africa. So for a domestic airline, no more than 25% of it can be foreign owned. So that makes it difficult to attract foreign investors, and in particular foreign airlines. I mean, I know for a fact there are foreign airlines, Middle Eastern airlines, for example, that would be interested in investing in this part of the world, but it's quite restrictive. So, you know, the pool of capital or the pool of investors is actually quite small. And when you overlay the investment case with, you know, without a management team that one has confidence in actually building the business, it becomes, you know, potentially uninvestable.
Could Takatso realistically have made it work?
Well, you know, we were involved because, you know, we bought the skills, not to say that we the best thing since sliced bread in terms of running airlines, but we've got skills, you know, had a great team at the time that we're keen to get involved. So I do think with that combination, and also importantly, I think a modest kind of approach to growth. You know, anytime people start talking about taking over the world with a route network and flying here and flying there, you know, that's when, you know, I think investors should get very worried when growth is, you know, the single objective as opposed to, you know, measured growth, profitable growth, adding capacity responsibly, not just throwing, you know, tons of aircraft into the market and that potentially has enough capacity already. So, you know, it's got to be measured and very conservative because it is such a risky business to start with.
Gideon Novick, thank you very much indeed. At one time, at the on the inside of the Takatso Consortium, looking to do a deal with government that fell apart yesterday. Gideon, thanks for your time.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. It's Thursday evening, brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. I want to reflect a little on what Trevor Manuel had to say today at the Daily Maverick gathering in Cape Town. It looked like a big crowd in that wonderful auditorium, which, as you go from the double-decker freeway into the city of Cape Town, it's that bit that juts out proudly onto the motorway there. And 1,000 people were treated to, I think, an astonishing day of thought-provoking discussions. But Trevor Manuel, I think, steals the show as a keynote speaker at this event. And it's just, I'll talk about it in just a moment. And then Pablo Fatidis at Auric Business Accelerator. He's with us tonight, as always, on Small Business, always challenging and thought-provoking. And then at 7:30, everything you need to know from the National Treasury tonight on the Twin Pot retirement system, which is coming into force later on this year. Bruce Cameron was on the radio 2 weeks ago. Bruce Cameron, the respected founder of Personal Finance in independent newspapers when it was good. And he is one of the most respected voices on issues of personal finance. But people were very cross with Bruce Cameron's take on the twin pot retirement system. People within the industry, observers of the industry, people who are not in the industry contacting me and saying, whoa, it can't be that bad, surely. So National Treasury tonight, just to give us a perspective this evening here on the Thursday evening edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show, brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Treat yourself if you would like to see what we're missing out on in terms of perspective and leadership and integrity. In a speech given today by Trevor Manuel, who I guess, like so many of his generation involved in South Africa's political transition in 1994, must be looking at the lost opportunity of 1994 and how well it was going up until about 2008, when things truly did fall apart in multiple levels. And people like Trevor Manuel are also partly responsible for things that have gone wrong in South Africa in terms of decision-making within cabinet on electricity provision and not getting the private sector involved earlier in the politics of that sort of time, all of that sort of stuff. We can stop pointing fingers and blame gaming as much as we like, but I did love what he had to say today about the disappointment at where we find ourselves as a country. And he says in his address today, and it's a really good address, you'll find it on the Daily Maverick website, we considered that the adoption of the Constitution was an end point, not fully realizing that rules need to be scribed and institutions built. Or perhaps it was just the struggle had been too long and arduous that we would resolve the incomplete business in the fullness of time. I think it's a big admission. And I think it's absolutely accurate in terms of, thank goodness we've got it. Yes, the bad guys are out, the good guys are in. And there was an enormously good period where Trevor Manuel, as Minister of Finance, who led the Treasury for the longest time anybody has been in charge of a national treasury, nearly 14 years, if memory serves, took us out of junk status into investment grade status and, you know, made some very big calls on the future direction of South Africa. He talks about the powers of legislation, the powers of government, and I think concerned about particularly the last decade and a bit of South Africa history where the wheels have come off. And one of the reasons why the wheels have come off is in the exercise of executive powers. One of those reasons is because the unfettered power, certainly in the Zuma era, and I think he is concerned about how that power may be misused into the future, that he draws attention to a whole range of issues from the National Development Plan, which he was overseeing and was drafted on his watch, and he spent an awful lot of time and energy traversing the country, getting buy into it. And it was a good document. It was a good, it just didn't have measurables and it didn't have a big stick with which to beat government departments with. And I've always found that something of a weakness of the NDP. And the people who are on the commission nowadays doing their very best to keep the dream of the NDP alive, but without true political buy-in and without structures in society that are going to help deliver the goals of a big plan as audacious and as courageous and as visionary as the NDP was and should still be and could well be into the future, I think, yeah, we need to get back to the drawing board on that particular plan. But just as an extract, the nice people at the Daily Maverick allowed us just a little bit of access to some of the audio from Trevor Manuel's presentation this morning. This is all about presidential powers and the risk that a country faces when one person has too much of it.
Perhaps in the drafting of our constitution, we wore rose-tinted spectacles and naively believed that all heads of state would act like Madiba and that presidential prerogatives would be exercised with care and attention. And now we look at life, and part of what we need to talk about in this next period are these immense areas of presidential prerogatives, which include the unfettered power to appoint cabinet and deputy ministers, too many of those, of course, the appointment of premiers, the appointment of heads of security agencies, and the appointment of our foreign representatives without query or oversight. It is this vast area of practice consonant with the spirit of our constitution, I ask. Now, we all appreciate that open-ended and protracted negotiations were obviously not in the interests of democracy. But should we not have returned to these matters later? Is it too late to amend the powers of the president, I ask?
It's an interesting conversation. It really is, and an important one. Have a look at it on the Daily Maverick website. He concludes to say the rupture, good word, of the Zuma and Ramaphosa years cannot be interpreted to require us to give up on the very fine values that bind us as a nation and articulated in our constitution. Part of the message here is we identify what is wrong and convene across political lines and seek the remedies. With the best will in the world, these matters will not be addressed in a new parliament, however constituted, from June. We need to debate with and also beyond the political parties. Absolutely. This stuff's too important to be left up to politicians. It really, really is. Trevor Manuel today at the gathering, hosted and convened and led by and driven by the Daily Maverick.
The Money Show.
Small business.
With Pavlo Fitidis.
And Pavlo on the line to us this evening. And it's good to have you back, Pavlo. You're a busy man and hard to pin down at the very best of times. Talk to me about small businesses and founders and whether or not a CEO should ever stop selling. Just explain in terms of, should the CEO be selling their shares, or should the CEO always be at the forefront of the process of the business? And of course, every business, no matter what you are, is all about selling the offering, the service, the product, whatever it might be.
Yes, and yesterday, Bruce, I had the opportunity to sit on this panel at this big event. It happened in London, and there were about, 400 or 500 business owners in the room. And of course, you know, the questions come from the floor. And one of the questions that was asked was exactly that. I'm a CEO. I started my business. Should I continue with the selling? I'm really good at it. I know my product well. I know my clients well. And as things stand, I'm seven years in. We're doing well, but I'm at the front and the head of every sale. Is that a good place to be? And it sounds like such a trite question, but it is so, so valuable, because the answer firstly begins and ends with, why do you do what you do? If what you're doing is to build a job, then it's easy. When you start, it starts with a sale. You stay selling. And when you look towards exiting, you liquidate. Because if you are the business and you're doing all the selling and no one else can, there's nothing to be transferred. But if you're building an asset, then as a CEO, you have to start. And you have to start by getting a first client on board. And that means you have to start selling.
Exactly. But it's very hard so often for founders to divorce themselves from the sales process, because they know it so well, because they're very good at it, because everybody they've ever dealt with knows them and trusts them and prefers to deal with them. The moment they try to withdraw, and there truly is a cold turkey moment, I think, in many small businesses, as the leader, the founder, tries to extricate themselves, people say, but hold on a second, I'm used to dealing with Pavlo. I only deal with Pavlo. Do you not know who I am? I'm incredibly important. And Pavlo knows me and will always take my calls. And all Pavlo is trying to do is get Bruce to do some of the selling for him, for example, or getting Bruce to run the business so that he can go and, I don't know, eat baklava, you know, three times a day, whatever the case might be.
That would lead to closure of the business very quickly. It's super sticky and super sweet. And I think you would die from perhaps having eaten too much of it.
Exactly.
But it's very true, Bruce, because in many ways, you know, when you start a business, you start with such deep, profound positivity and excitement, but also deep, profound insecurities. And if you're a thinking person, if you have some drive, if you have some ambition, the word no, when you make an offer to a potential customer, is extremely painful. And if you're that thinking person, you're going to start thinking as to why. Why was the answer no? Is there something that I need to do with my product? Is this something I need to do with my service? Is it the way I am? Is it the way I speak? Is it the way I present? And over a period of time, the many, many no's start to turn into one or two yeses, and your confidence starts coming back in. And with your confidence coming back in, every time there's a no, you ask why. And that's the most fundamental and critical part or path that every business has to go through in order to define its purpose. Why does it exist? Most people think that their businesses exist to sell a product or sell a service. But actually, that's not the case. You know, you exist to really help someone resolve a problem in whatever shape or form it might be. So if you don't start selling, if you don't lead it as the founder, as the CEO, you'll never learn your purpose. And if you never learn your purpose, you'll never be able to transcend where you have started to where you need to go, which is securing and getting traction in the marketplace in order to build a platform against which you can scale and grow the business. If you don't know what your purpose is, you can't do any of those factors. So you need to start by selling, and you need to continue until you've got really a clear definition of purpose.
Absolutely. But that can take a period of time. And of course, you want to extricate yourself from the daily process in as quickly as you possibly can without doing any harm, of course, to the business itself. How do you know? When is a teenager ready to leave the house? Some teenagers are ready to leave the house only at the age of 25. It's a bit like that, isn't it?
It is and it isn't, because in some cases, it takes a longer period of time for people to learn purpose. And here's the thing, it has to get inordinately messy before it starts becoming neater and cleaner and simpler. So to get your purpose right, in many ways, what you're going to do is sell to anyone, anywhere, anyhow, every time, each time, all the time. And eventually, over a period of time, you'll start to notice that some people respond quicker, some people come back for more. And in doing so, you then start identifying who actually resonates with what you have to offer. In defining that purpose, Bruce, the next thing is to say, well, we're not a business that offers, let's say, eye drops. We're a business that offers relief to eye strain. That's what the definition of purpose is. It has nothing to do with your product. It has everything to do with the problem that gets solved. The next question and the next thing you have to get right before you onboard one of the most expensive assets in your business, which is a sales team, is you need to understand what experience you need to create for people who are looking to relieve their eye strain. In other words, what do they need to learn? What do they need to read about? What do they need to hear to select your particular, let's call it eye relief product, as opposed to any others? And that defines positioning. And once you've got those two pieces in place, the third step, Bruce, is you need to decode everything you've done. And ideally, you need to get someone to reflect back and look at you and say, when you approach the market, you do A, then B, then C, then D, and that gives you the outcome. And that is the very early stage of creating activities into a sequence that can be measured, but teachable activities. Because in decoding yourself based on how you've effectively and successfully sold your eyedrops into the marketplace, you're able to build a system behind it. And a system means you now can recruit somebody, train them, teach them, and have them run the system that in effect has decoded the way you sell, so they, in many ways, start to sell in a manner that is already proven to be successful.
Okay, so public, then practically, as we look at this and we try to figure out the best way and when to unleash our sales team without supervision, comes to a point where you're ready to scale and you want to accelerate the growth of your business. You want to ensure that this business can exist without you. Because otherwise, if you're permanently embedded in the business and you're wedded to the business, you're the one, the Muppet, who is there at 5 o'clock in the morning and still going 10 o'clock at night. And nobody else seems to be as stressed as you. Nobody else seems to take the ownership nearly as much as you. And I think that can, in many founders, if you don't create the systems and the processes early enough, you will start resenting the people who you thought were so wonderful the moment you hired them. And unless you empower them to do what you hired them to do, you're going to be the idiot, aren't you?
Completely. And you know how most people recruit, Bruce? So you're looking for a salesperson, right? What you used to do in the old days, about a year ago, is you would have gone onto the internet, you would have gone onto Google, and you would have said, give me a sales job description for a salesperson. And you would have taken one or two templates or three or four templates. You would have joined them all together and cleaned it up a little bit. And with that, you would have had a job description for a salesperson. You then provide that to a recruiter, because in the old days, you used to be able to get LinkedIn to do the job for you. But nowadays, you provide it to a recruiter, and a recruiter gives you three CVs of three people with long sales experiences and lots of sales history. And you hire one of those people based on some magical thing that just twigged for you in that CV that you read. And 6 months down the line, you're still doing all the selling. And this happens frequently, far more frequently than anyone anticipates. The thing is, if you rather build a selling system before you employ someone to operate for you, you're already ahead of the pack. Because if I said to you, for example, Bruce, come into my business and make an omelet, as opposed to come into my business and together we're going to make an omelet. This is how you crack the eggs. This is how you whisk them up. These are the condiments you add. This is how you hold the pan. This is how you flip the omelet. A system means I can show and teach, and you can have the ability to then copy, learn, and make it your own. The real magic, though, comes in if that system is something we build together. So you are successful in selling as the founder. You employ your first salesperson based on their values, their character, the sense that they have the aptitude to fulfill these activities. And then you redefine your selling system, the activities that get someone's attention and the activities that build trust and confidence that you're the right party against which they're going to buy their products from. When you do it that way, Bruce, you get full buy-in by your sales team. And that immediately means you can start taking a step back to manage by way of coaching as opposed to manage by way of interfering.
And the difference is vast, isn't it? I mean, I'm the manager. I tell you what to do. You go out and do it, rather than the coaching analogy, which I think is far more powerful and sustainable and is more likely to keep people engaged for longer periods of time. Otherwise, you're going to be doing a lot of bossing people around, new faces every single week, if you can't hold on to your sales team.
Yeah, and it'll all be delegated back up to you. But if you do it in this manner, it allows you to actually start stepping out of the kitchen altogether. You'll have a team that has a system for making omelets in the way that your business has become known for making omelets, if we continue with that analogy. And there will be a bit of change, and there will be a bit of character to each of the individual omelets, because you're employing people who have personalities, who have character. And if you manage and coach people in that manner, it builds confidence. And when it builds confidence, people are able to make the omelets better than the system itself would have allowed them to make omelets. And when they're making them better and they're selling more of them, their confidence builds. And when their confidence builds, they want to do even better, because that's the nature of all of us as human beings. Yeah. It is a right and ready way to then have you step away from front-end selling to where you eventually are going, and that is towards possibly 10, 15, 20 years down the line, perhaps an exit. And when you start moving towards an exit,
so important, Pavlo, sorry to interrupt you, but so important that you keep telling us that 94% of businesses, you keep telling us that businesses, 94% of businesses that are started will never be sold. And one of the reasons is because people have kept themselves to themselves and have not released the power of the team onto their customers, and so there is nothing left to sell because you're too old and decrepit to keep doing it yourself, and so kind of the business fades away as you do, and it's tragic, isn't it?
It is, and you know, it's such a complicated idea until it's suddenly not, because in many ways, the success of the business needs to be owned by the business. It cannot vest in you as an individual. And truthfully, Bruce, it can't even invest in any of your people, because anyone looking to acquire a business is saying, without Bruce there, and in fact, possibly without some of his team members there who are committed to him, will this business be able to perform in the future the way it's performed in the last 2-3 years before I buy it? And if that question can't be answered in the affirmative, you truly do not have a saleable asset. And Bruce, it is a crisis for most people to only realize this in the later stages of their career, where they're looking to move towards an exit, where they're looking to move towards redefining the later years of their career, their lives, suddenly realizing that for the last 10, 20, 30 years, the business that has done well by you is not going to give you that fantastic, elegant, graceful exit. If you are square and center involved in the sales activities day in and out, then you've got a job. You haven't succeeded in building an asset. So yes, as a CEO, you must always be selling, but sell to clients, get the business right, sell to a team to onboard them, and then eventually learn to sell the asset to a potential new buyer and exit with grace.
And that is a wonderful place to say exit with grace. Now, Pavlo, thank you very much indeed. I don't know who Grace is, but yeah, I'm sure she's lovely. Thank you, Pavlo Fatidis at Auric Business Accelerator. After Eyewitness News Now with Maki Malapo, we're going to be revisiting the Twin Pot Pension Fund System. Everything you need to know, Christopher Axelson at National Treasury to explain.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
That Little Eden advert has just brought back memories of 1994 and convincing the news editor at the time, Jeremy Maggs, that what I needed to do was to get into a wheelchair and wheel myself down around downtown Johannesburg to see just how accessible it all was. And, oh my goodness me, I think my kidneys are still trying to recover. The pressure that a wheelchair puts on you, on bits of you that you didn't know existed, and just the ability to be able to get out of a wheelchair and stretch and realize the privilege of having working limbs was good. It was a really important thing to do. I encourage you to participate. Well, on to the Twin Pot Pension Fund System. A couple of weeks ago, Bruce Cameron was with us. Bruce Cameron, of course, one of South Africa's most respected veterans of personal finance, and the most awarded personal finance journalist in history. I think my official French is coming very close to his record of personal finance awards at the Sanlam Awards. But Bruce Cameron knows a thing or two about it. But he was particularly eviscerating of the idea of the twin pot, the two-pot pension fund system. And a lot of people were quite put out by it, saying, hold on a second, he's in some respects absolutely right, and in some he's bitten off the wrong end of the stick, if I'm going to mix some metaphors. Christopher Axelson is with us. Christopher is the acting head of tax and financial sector policy at National Treasury. I'm going to go about it right from the very start, if I can, Christopher, and just go back to the motivation behind creating a twin pot financials pension system that allows, into the future at least, access to some of your long-term savings. Just take me through the thinking, if you would.
Yeah, sure. Good evening, Chris, and good evening, everyone. So, I mean, this actually started a long time ago. National Treasury started putting out discussion documents on how to reform the retirement system in 2012. And even then, we realized that there is one big problem in our current system. And the big problem in our current system is that as soon as you resign from your job, you can actually take the full value of your pension fund or your provident fund as cash. And we looked at some of the SARS data, and you know, more than 700,000 people per year were doing just that. So if you keep on taking your retirement funds out as cash as you go through your career, it doesn't get any compound growth, it reduces in value, and then we see very poor retirement outcomes, people who get to retirement, but they don't actually have enough. So that was the one problem. The second issue is that individuals in severe financial distress can't actually access those amounts. And the only way to access it is to resign from your job. So there was this incentive for people who are now in a difficult position to then resign to get access to those funds. which isn't in their longer term interest because they've lost a job and they've lost income, but it helps them in the short term. And with the onset of COVID, this pressure to provide some access was elevated. So we've tried to fix both problems by this two-pot system. So on the one hand, we're saying, okay, we've got a new retirement pot, and two-thirds of the amount that goes into that pot, you can't access, even if you resign your job. It has to stay there. It gives compound growth, and hopefully you'll have a larger amount when you finally retire. But there is also this one-third savings pot, and that will then allow individuals to have access to that amount so that if they are in severe financial distress, they don't need to resign from their jobs and they can get some access. So we're trying to get a system that has the best of both worlds and leads to better outcomes for everyone.
What sort of global best practice did you draw on to devise this scheme? Because, I mean, it's taken a lot of thought and a lot of engineering to get us to this point.
So, I mean, we do look at a lot of other countries, and the big thing they have is this preservation of retirement savings. So it's preserved in those retirement funds. And then it can grow, and then when people finally get to retirement, they can actually have a good amount to retire on. A lot of countries, even through COVID, especially in the developing world, started to have a little bit of access to those funds to also try and help with distress and financial distress. So it's we did look at a lot of other countries. Some of them had a bit more pre-retirement access than others, but the ones which had the best outcomes was that they preserved those amounts all the way through to retirement. The problem is in developed economies, there's a much better social safety net. So if you do fall under hard times, the government will pay for you. Whereas here, it's quite a different scenario, and we need to try and change our systems for that context.
No, exactly right. I mean, and also in growing economies, if you resign your job to get access to your pension fund, which is never a smart thing to do, you end up not being able to get another job in South Africa. Well, the odds are that you may struggle to get another job, and that sets you back even further. So not only have you undermined your long-term savings, but in the short term, you miss out on income. And I think that catches a lot of people unawares as well. People kind of think, well, I'll quit my job and then go and start a new one and it'll all be fine. And sometimes you get lucky and sometimes you don't. In fast-growing economies, you've got more options. And South Africa's got, sadly, fewer and fewer of those.
Yes, I think that's right.
So we're talking this evening on the two-pot pension fund system. Christopher Axelson explaining the context for us as to why this system has been instituted, the acting head of tax and financial sector policy at National Treasury. More questions for him coming up in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Investment School.
Christopher Axelson, the acting head of tax and financial sector policy at National Treasury. It all comes into force later on this year, Christopher, in terms of the twin pot, the two pot pension fund system. It only is applicable on new money from August, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So, I mean, a lot of people are calling it a three-pot system because, I mentioned this retirement pot where two-thirds of your future contributions from 1 September 2024 will go into this retirement pot that must be preserved until retirement. One-third goes into this savings pot, which you can have access to once a year, and the minimum withdrawal will be 2,000 Rand. But there is actually a third pot called the vested pot, and that's only for people who have saved up to this point. So all the rules and all the benefits of the current system that we have will still be applicable to those funds. So if, for example, you were to resign in a few years' time, you can still access the amount in that vested pot and the growth in that amount. But going forward, for new people who don't have any old vested amounts, there will only be those two pots that you can contribute in 2 years.
Okay. Bruce Cameron's concern about this, of course, is that people start treating it a bit like a piggy bank, start saying, well, you know, when I fancy a holiday, I'm going to fib and say I'm going to have a knee operation and I'm going to go to Mauritius instead. And it doesn't, with a level of education when it comes to long-term savings and with a lack of education within our schooling system and a lack of appreciation of just how blooming hard it is to build up savings, I wonder if we are not at risk here of people doing themselves through no fault of their own, well, it is their fault, but because they don't necessarily appreciate the extent of what's going on, that they do themselves long-term financial harm by dipping into long-term savings when perhaps they shouldn't.
No, and I think, you know, it's a valid concern to have, but in our view, the current system is actually worse because you can take out the full 100% of those amounts, and lots of people do. So, you know, they want that trip to Mauritius and they'll take the full 100% off and they'll say, well, I'll start saving next year and they start from scratch. Whereas in this new system, that 2/3 of that amount just cannot be touched. And in our view, that amount can grow, there'll be compound growth in it, it'll stay there. If you start contributing in your 20s, it'll stay there that whole time until you retire. So we think the benefit of preserving the 2/3 amount will really outweigh, you know, the potential cost from having access to 1/3. We are trying to tell and, you know, educate people that 1/3 should not be seen as a 13th check. I mean, it really is supposed to only be for emergencies, for if you are in financial distress. We are trying to incentivize people to keep the money in there as well, because if you withdraw it, you will get taxed at your marginal rates. And if you've got income, you'll get taxed at quite a high rate. Yes.
This is the
Whereas
important
if you
thing
keep it
to,
in
to
pot,
make a point here. Yes.
Yes, sorry. So if you keep it in the savings pot until you retire and you don't take it out of that savings pot, up to 550,000 Rand will be tax-free. So we're trying to give you a tax incentive to keep it in that savings pot, but it's there if you really need it. If you have come under financial distress and you don't have any income, then you'll get much lower tax rates on the amount that you actually pull out of those funds. So that's what we're trying to push people to do, but obviously there is the risk that they just take it every year, but at least 2/3 will be preserved, whereas at the moment, many people don't preserve anything.
Am I going to have to jump through some sort of a hoop if I want to access some of my savings? Am I going to have to explain to somebody? Am I going to have to go and fill in an affidavit or give a blood sample or something? If I suddenly have a shortfall and I need, I don't know, 10,000 Rand or 100,000 Rand or whatever the case might be, depending on the size of my savings, do I need to justify it to anybody, or is it simply my right to access what I want when I want it?
No, it's your right to access, so you don't need to jump through any hoops. You know, you can try and create hoops and people will, you know, barriers, and they will get around them. So we've made it open, but you can only withdraw once a year.
Okay. And so, yes, I see the logic in it. But again, for many people, there is a concern that we're making, taking away from the integrity of the retirement system. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily what it does it?
No, we don't think so at all. I mean, if there are people who want to save the full amount, they can, and they don't need to, you know, take money out of that savings pot. We're certainly not telling people to take out of that savings pot. That's there for, you know, very exceptional circumstances, which we would like to tell people. And that 1/3, you know, if people do take that out, at least they do have the preservation on the other side, which they haven't had before. But there are other benefits to this, because at the moment we have a retirement annuity funds, you have provident funds, you have pension funds. With this system, we're creating one fund. They're all going to look exactly the same. And you're going to be able to transfer to other providers. Hopefully it will help to reduce costs for members, because now you've only got one type of retirement fund that has the same rules. So we think that there are other benefits to this. And it gives individuals a little bit more flexibility in terms of managing their own finances. But because of that 2/3 that's locked away, you know, we really do hope and believe it should lead to better outcomes.
You talk about it, you say you hope it will lead to cost reductions, but at the same time, there's an increased administrative burden now on pension fund companies who have to administer the ins and outs and the withdrawals and the monitoring of people's accounts. Surely this leads to increased costs over time.
Well, I think if all, you know, at the moment, there are so many different funds. And part of these discussion papers that Treasury were putting out in the previous years was about, you know, the fact we need to consolidate the number of funds. There need to be far fewer funds so that the administrative costs of running this whole industry is a lot lower. And then the costs per member are cheaper. If you move to a system where all the funds are the same, it should be easier, hopefully, for those administrators to then administer and transfer funds between the different types of funds so that there can be more competition to bring those costs down. There will be some initial upfront costs because of the administrative complexity of this, but there shouldn't be, you know, any consumer-facing complexities. Those administrators can deal with it in the background, get their systems up and running, and then hopefully we can have the system in place for quite a long time, although there's always seems to be retirement reforms. But if we have the system in place for a long time, gradually those costs should come down.
I mean, surely reform is part of the process. It's got to get better and better and better. There can be no sort of fixed way of doing things in perpetuity. Otherwise, frankly, we were still stuck with a retirement system that had been around 25 years ago. I think we'd all be in trouble. Talk to me about the potential restriction then on pension funds. I mean, is this something that is being seriously looked at? Is it a call or is it an indicator of policy changes into the future?
Which restriction are you talking about exactly?
You suggested that there were too many pension funds, we should simplify the system and therefore should be fewer options for us to invest in. At least that's how I interpreted it.
Oh, yes. Okay. No, I think that was more about a push and a call for, you know, the funds themselves to consolidate so that they could join with other funds. You know, at the moment, you've got, for example, pension funds that have different rules to retirement annuity funds, that have different rules to provident funds, different rules to provident preservation funds. Now, going forward, you're going to have one type of retirement fund, that is this two-pot system, and you'll have vested pots within each, you know, in the background of each of these funds. So we're hoping that it should be easier for funds to then consolidate so that you only have, you have far fewer administrative, you know, staff members, administrative processes, if you've got fewer funds so that it reduces those costs. We're not forcing that upon industry. We're just trying to create the conditions to lower those costs.
Sure. PJ Smith on my Twitter account this evening says, what about people who are with the Government Employees Pension Fund? Government Employees Pension Fund, of course, is a defined benefits fund. In other words, you kind of know what you're going to get in perpetuity. Does that apply to them as well?
Yes, so this applies to all funds. We're changing the GEPF law to include all these funds. It's been supported and pushed by Kasatu as well. Even though it's a defined benefit fund, the actuaries can still calculate the value of the cash that you would want to withdraw from your savings account, and they can reduce that from the final gratuity that you get when you actually retire at the end. So it will still be applicable to those and to all other funds. They aren't the only exceptions are for some legacy retirement annuity funds and for some provident funds where their members were quite close to retirement. But for everyone else, they will be included.
And so how then do you identify whether your fund is included or excluded? What happens there?
In the vast, vast majority of cases, your fund will be included. If you are part of a provident fund and you are older than 55 on 1 March 2021, you have the option to keep your current fund and keep doing what you want to do. But you also have the option to move to the two-pot system. You just tell your fund that you want to actually move to this new regime. And then you can't go back, but then you will be part of the new two-pot system. The only others are these legacy retirement annuity funds that were sold by some insurers. Those ones won't change, but all the other funds should be included. But the funds and the trustees of the funds will most definitely communicate with all their members to tell them all about this. We're still finalizing the legislation. It's getting very close. There has been quite a push, but there will be communications to all the members from the trustees to explain what is happening and whether your fund is included.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I found it absolutely fascinating and getting an explanation from National Treasury. Christopher Axelson, the Acting Head of Tax and Financial Sector Policy at National Treasury. For those of you who had concerns about this new twin pot system, I hope that answers your questions. Certainly no questions have come through this evening. I'm guessing that means that you are satisfied. If you have further questions, of course, do get in touch. Do let us know and do alert us to the fact that you have further questions. because we like your questions. Your questions help fuel the excitement and the vigour that we feel each and every single day as we awake to prepare each new edition of The Money Show.